A leader in moving Alaska Native tribes to greater self-determination died over the weekend. Jacqueline Estes has this story on the life of Niall Caesar.
A Tlingit Indian from Juneau, Niall Caesar, served 20 years in the Medical Service Corps, including a year in Vietnam. He retired from the Navy as a lieutenant, then completed a bachelor's degree in environmental health. From 1979 to 1990, Caesar was executive vice president of the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. For the next 19 years, he served as director for the Alaska Bureau of Indian Affairs. His colleague there, Charles Bunch, says Caesar headed the region after the Indian Self-Determination and Educational Assistance Act opened the door for increased tribal self-determination and the transfer of responsibility for direct services from the agency to tribes.
Almost half of the recognized federal tribes in the United States are in Alaska, and Niles made great strides in helping them to contract out those government services.
Bunch says Caesar's push for self-determination carried through to his advocacy for a mainstay of Native life.
I think that the natives of Alaska have lost a champion as one of the members of the Federal Subsistence Board. I think Niles worked hard to ensure that way of life was continued in Alaska.
Caesar served on the boards of the Native Corporation Sea Alaska and Gold Belt and was a council member on the Juneau, Tlingit, and Haida Community Council. He was a member of the Raven Moiety and Thluka Udi clan. Anchorage services will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday at the St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. The family plans to announce Juneau services soon. Niall Caesar passed away Saturday at age 70 after a long struggle with cancer. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A standoff over proposed changes to the state's oil tax regime turned a little personal over the past week, and differences have firmed up over how oil companies should be treated. In a letter to Senate Finance Committee Co-Chairman Bert Stedman, Governor Sean Parnell late last week referred to those senators working on a substitute tax reduction plan to replace the bill that he introduced last year. He likened them to, quote, a group of hens in the barnyard. Later, he asked Stedman not to, quote, shoot explorers in the head while they look for new sources of oil. The letter was a comment on a speech that Stedman had delivered to the Juneau Chamber of Commerce last week in support of a tax proposal that the Senate is pursuing. Stedman saw the letter as entertaining and dismissed it, saying the subject of taxation is unrelated to chickens, but he didn't back down from the Senate's plan or the goal of a new tax plan. He said they need more discussion on recent issues that have recently arisen.
There's certainly more substantive issues than we have time to address, but we're going to tomorrow kick off at 9 o'clock with industry. The three majors, Exxon, BP, and Conoco, will be testifying. And then we'll have PFC Energy the following day, our consultant, and we'll start working on alterations of the bill and continue to try to evolve that and solve as many problems as time will allow.
Parnell said the letter was what he called a proportional response to Stedman's speech, asking that the focus of discussions be on getting more production on the North Slope. Meanwhile, the Senate's work on providing oil incentives is not meeting the favor of the governor. In a press conference yesterday afternoon, Parnell criticized the Senate for missing a self-imposed deadline of giving its bill, Senate Bill 192, to the House by last Friday. He was asked specifically whether he would veto the Senate bill.
26 days is a lifetime in the legislative hallways. You know that, and I know that. I do not support SB 192 in its current form. I still believe, though, that the Senate Finance Committee can make some changes, and I believe, obviously, it's a Senate bill. The House can make some changes, so a lot can transpire.
Both the governor and the Senate have bills offering tax cuts in different ways. The governor's offers more reductions, and the industry is pushing that. Parnell yesterday pointed to production promises that have been attached to his tax regime being in place. BP last month promised $5 billion in new investment if the governor's bill were to pass. The governor yesterday also announced a commitment by Armstrong Oil and Gas, a newcomer in the state, of an additional $9 billion in new investment. He said the company linked that to his tax plan.
Unless there are companies willing to step forward with money in exchange for a new tax regime, then you got to question whether the tax regime is worth implementing and whether it will create new business.
Stedman said the state will need more investment than what BP has offered to get production to the million barrels a day production goal that the governor has set.
Although it might sound like a lot of money and very attractive, but when you actually look at the funds that's needed, the investment that's needed to go after this incremental oil production, it's not going to do it.
Stedman says he anticipates the Senate Finance Committee having the bill ready for a vote sometime early next week. The former Exxon Valdez is heading to the scrap heap. As the 23rd anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill approaches, the tanker that ran aground in Prince William Sound and spilled millions of gallons of crude oil will be scrapped in Asia. As Tony Gorman reports, the oil spill wasn't the Exxon Valdez's last incident, and this isn't the first time the tanker has changed hands.
The vessel, now known as the Oriental Nicety, sailed through some rocky waters during its time, but none were bigger than the disaster that occurred on March 24, 1989, when the then Exxon Valdez struck the Blair Reef, spilling 11 million gallons of oil into the Prince William Sound. Until the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill, it was the largest spill in U.S. history. The incident caused over $3 billion in damages and led to the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. The law required owners to phase out single-hull ships. Now the vessel is heading to the scrapyard after a 26-year run. Maryland-based ship cash buyer Global Marketing Systems Incorporated says it was purchased by a Singapore company for $16 million. The deal is still being finalized. This isn't the first time the vessel has changed hands. After the oil spill, it was repaired and renamed the Exxon Mediterranean in 1990. The vessel was transferred to shipping subsidiary River Maritime Incorporated in 1993 as the Sea River Mediterranean. In 2007, it was converted to an ore bulk carrier and sold to Hong Kong Bloom Shipping. Under the name Don Fang Ocean, it was severely damaged after a collision with a Maltese cargo ship in 2010. It is unknown as to when it will make its final voyage to the scrapyard, which is in India. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
The Air Force is replacing handles that engage the F-22 Raptor fighter jet's emergency oxygen system after numerous reports of pilots reporting feeling lightheadedness. The move comes after the death in 2010 of pilot Captain Jeffrey Haney when a stealth fighter crashed about 100 miles north of Anchorage. Haney's widow has filed a wrongful death lawsuit that claims the plane's onboard oxygen delivery system is defective. The lawsuit says the manual activation mechanism for the backup system is underneath and behind the pilot. That's impossible to reach while flying at supersonic speeds. The Air Force's entire fleet was placed on temporary stand down last summer after pilots reported lightheadedness and other symptoms consistent with them not receiving enough oxygen. F-22s are based in Alaska, Hawaii, Nevada, Virginia, New Mexico, and Florida.